Radio free readout begins in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Patriots to Radio Free Redoubt. This is episode 1839, broadcasting live from the heart of the American Redoubt, from the free zones, blasting out across the wire into occupied territory. Have hope you're not alone. If you're a God-fearing, liberty-loving patriot, well, your name is my name too. Thank you guys for tuning in. I hope you had a blessed week. Everybody's all ramped up and excited for the midterm elections coming up. There's a lot on the line, a lot at stake, and we're kind of excited about this this animated contest for freedom in America. So we're going to have some stuff, some coverage. I'm going to talk about that here. It's going to tie into the news and commentary. Don't forget to help spread the word. Folks can listen in by, well, you can just go to radiofreeredoubt.com and click on the tab that says listen to RFR, and it will give you instructions on, you know, how to listen to our Saturday morning show, our Sunday evening podcast that you're listening to right now, unless you're listening to the uploaded version on Podbean. Download that. But thank you guys for being out there. Thank you for your prayers of support. Let's see. We got a special guest coming up tonight, Sam Culper from Forward Observer. We're going to talk about in this Civil War II series, is it possible that we could be facing a civil war? Everybody seems to be talking about it. He's got a little bit different take on, at least the label civil war. So, we'll get his input. I'm really looking forward to it. It's been good talking to him this week as we were kind of prepping for this. So we'll get him on here in just a little bit. But first, let's get down to the news and commentary brought to you by the author Glenn Tate and his 299 Days book series. All 10 books are out, including the audio book. So check those out at 299days.com. All right. First up, this is you guys following this, the new Brazil's Trump. Well, he won the election this week. So for this is out of off of Reuters. Pick this up off of Drudge report. For Brazil's right-wing president-elect Jair Bolsonaro. Hopefully I pronounce his first name right. If not, well, I'm an American, doggone it. I speak American, so sorry about that. But anyway, they're kind of labeling him as South America's Trump, as this wave of nationalism, populist nationalistic movement, where people are actually becoming patriots, loving their own country, wanting to preserve it. They're shunning globalism. And the left doesn't like it, but we're seeing this across Europe. We're going to talk about that with Sam Culper tonight too. Very interesting what's taking place. People want to love their country, their homeland. Well, anyway, they're saying that he's attacking critical press outlets almost daily on social media. He said that's not enough. Once he's in office, he vows to hit their bottom line with $500 million in public sector marketing budgets coming under his discretion. The fiery former army captain is threatening to slash ad buys with adversarial media groups striking at the financial foundation of Brazil's free press. They're calling it free press. They've got their versions of fake media too, and he's tired of it being funded, biased, partisan coverage being funded by the taxpayers. I think, you know, hopefully maybe President Trump's paying attention to this, might give him a few ideas to actually go after NPR. How's that sound? Not National Public Radio, paid for propaganda paid for by your tax dollars and mine. So take some lessons here. After a campaign in which Bolsonaro dismissed investigative reporting as fake news, invented by a corrupt establishment, and his supporters went after individual journalists, the threats are sending a chill through the country's newsrooms. Good. These guys report irresponsibly with impunity, like we're continuing to see even here. In the social media side of things, Twitter deletes 10,000 accounts for the midterms at the Democrats' bidding, apparently. This is from One News Now. A partisan Democratic group claiming that bots were responsible for tweeting messages to undermine the 2018 midterm elections spurred Twitter to delete more than 10,000 user accounts. Twitter, which along with Google and Facebook, reportedly has employees donating to Democrats over Republicans nearly 10 to 1, took the Democrats' referrals at their word with little hesitation and eradicated 10,000 accounts to keep them from quote-unquote unfairly affecting the elections on November 6th. What shenanigans we got going on here. According to The Blaze, Twitter indicates that the user accounts were trying to persuade voters to stay home on Election Day, which would suppress the vote for the pivotal midterm elections on Tuesday. But the way they chose these accounts was by referral from Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. From the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, a group supporting campaigns of Democrats, to the U.S. House of Representatives. Why are we not surprised? Here's what this was disturbing. But also at One News Now, Dr. Michael Brown wrote a guest column really nailing this. But if you guys didn't hear about this, the CNN's Don Lemon said, quote, I watched him. I heard his words. He said, we have to stop demonizing people and realize that the biggest terror threat in this country is white men, most of them radicalized to the right, and we have to start doing something about them. And this Dr. Michael Brown asked, as for the uproar, where is it? As for CNN's response, a CNN spokeswoman said Wednesday neither Lemon nor the network would speak more about it. So, no big deal, nothing to talk about, controversy over. Unreal. And he goes on to point out Megyn Kelly's blackface comment. I think this was for Halloween, somebody painting their face black and going as blackface. The left just came unhinged. That apparently was the straw that broke the camel's back, leading to her firing by NBC. And he notes what a contrast that is. And he asks the question, if her comment was offensive, well, he states this was beyond offensive. White males are terrorists. That's what this guy, this Lemon guy, Don Lemon from CNN. So more division. There's no call for unity any longer. They're responding to the calls of people like Hillary saying it's time to remove civility. Stop being civil. Let's be confrontational. Let's keep the division going. That's a communist tactic. All right. A little bit of prepper news here. Heads up, folks, for our patriots in the former land of milk and honey. The paradise, former paradise known as California, was hit by 39 earthquakes in 24 hours. Scientists are warning of movement along the San Andreas Fault, which is not really a big news flash, but this is unusual. This article says, in recent months, there's been an alarming amount of seismic activity all along the Ring of Fire. That's the, you know, all the way around the Pacific. And there have been times when the number of global earthquakes has been way above normal. And they ask, could it be possible all this unusual seismic activity is leading up to something? Well, I would say yes. And most of them are saying yes. So we're seeing this also. We saw a swarm of earthquakes took place right off of Vancouver, just getting northwest of, Puget Sound, Seattle area, all up and down the coast. So That Cascadia subduction zone that they say is going to break loose at some point, scientists are saying, is going to be catastrophic. Some of these communities won't be accessible for days to weeks and even months. And according to one debriefing from the Washington Military Department, their equivalent of, you know, like FEMA, they're saying that they had to notify some of these communities to be self-sufficient, or you're going to be on your own, rather, for up to a year because of how catastrophic the earthquake that they're expecting will be, with combined with the follow-on tsunami. So anyway, we continue to train, in emergency communications, where we've provided emergency communications to help folks in danger, in harm's way, in wildfires and hurricanes and floods. And we continue to do the same so we can serve our fellow countrymen. We don't look forward to that event, but we stand ready for it. Let's just put it that way. Down on the southern border, U.S. militia groups are heading there. Apparently, according to this article, which is MSN, Microsoft Network. Is that right? That's MSN, Microsoft Network. They're saying gun-carrying civilian groups. That would be the militia. But that's a bad word. Tui, right? So, and border vigilantes, people taking the law into their own hands. That's what that means. Have heard a call to arms in President Trump's warnings about threats to American security posed by caravans of Central American migrants moving through Mexico. They're packing coolers and tents, oiling their rifles, tuning up aerial drones, and plans to form caravans of their own and trail American troops to the border. Now, you know, if ever there was a legitimate reason to call out the militias, which Congress can do, by the way, this would be it. They don't have to be vigilantes. They can be under a chain of command and responsible and given a sensible set of rules of engagement. These guys are saying, we're just going to observe and report. That's it. They're going there with binoculars, but you have every right to be armed and defend, be prepared to defend life. Because there's drug cartels and there's all kinds of other criminal type of activity out there in that desert. It's the Wild West. You'd be foolish not to go out armed. And this is a proper role for militia. Gun-carrying civilian groups. Well, remember, the argument is that's for trained professionals only. Most of these gun-carrying civilian group border vigilantes are actually former military veterans, many of them combat veterans, who have been not only professionally trained, they've been professional trainers. So it's very appropriate. That's very American, but it's very foreign to globalist-minded people, especially that are trying to uproot Americanism. Let's go on to the rhinopack.org. That's R-H-I-N-O. That's Rhino Hunters in the Northwest, North Idaho. Anyway, it's rhinopack.org. Really love these guys. They are tracking down Republicans in name only. People that say they're Republicans and stand for the Republican Party platform, but their actions don't match up with their words or with the words of the Republican Party platform that they say they will follow, adhere to, but aren't. So these guys are calling them out. Well, on this website, rhinopack.org, they have that drop-down menu, stark raving mad, some crazy stories, crazy but true stories. I got a couple here I want to share with you. Idaho teachers build the wall. This happened I was laughing when I saw this. This is out of Middleton, Idaho. It's just north of Boise. Middleton School District administrators are enraged over a group of teachers who dressed up for Halloween as the wall, Even more egregious, the front of their wall was emblazoned with the slogan, "Make America Great Again." Oh, the horror! Make America Great Again. That's racist. It was written in red, white, and blue, which is nationalistic and divisive, probably offensive to somebody, maybe even the French, because they have red, white, and blue flags, right? We're cultural appropriation going on here. But the teachers would actually express even a hint of pro-American sentiment immediately sent the district's administrative staff into a tizzy. Rumors have it that the school officials, many suffering from TDS, that's Trump Derangement Syndrome, by the way, have called for the miscreants to be burned at the stake, according to this article. I don't know if they actually said that, but they were probably thinking it. That would be my guess. So even for us, the news came as a shock. We thought that the term conservative teacher had become an oxymoron. Well, happily, we've been proven incorrect. They got the story and a link there. At the bottom of that. And the other one, the MAGA bomber, as they love calling him, turns out to be a lifelong Democrat. And I pointed this out in my show last week. But the legacy media was quick to label Cesar Sayrok, the so-called MAGA bomber, as a white, Trump-loving, lifelong conservative Republican. Well, the legacy media were wrong on all counts. Cesar Sayrok, who went by several other names as well, was registered as a Democrat from 1980 to 2016. That's 36 years a Democrat. He changed to R, Republican, just before the 2016 elections. Further, a cursory review of his background reveals multiple social media posts hating Republicans and the GOP, bashing George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, posting photos of Bush and Cheney as war criminals, and praising Code Pink, that's liberal women, as the beautiful women of the world. Sayrok is the son of two full-blooded Filipinos. White men who aren't white, bombs that aren't bombs, Republicans who are actually Democrats, just another day in the life of the fake news media. So you can read that and more at the Stark Raving Mad page at rhinopack.org. All right, coming back with segment two, we'll bring Sam Culper on if you stick around. This is Radio Free Redoubt.
It's down to the wire, and we Christian patriots have a duty. Some are asking, given the choices we have, why even vote? I'll tell you why, with a question. Do you think there are only two people running for public office this November? John Jacob, Matt Shea, Heather Scott, and many others have been saying it for a long time. We will never fix this country's problems from Washington, D.C. Our solutions are at the local level. There are good, conservative, God-fearing patriots on the ballot who need your vote. From city council positions to county commissioners, legislators, and many more. Christians make up the largest demographic who are not registered to vote. They also make up the largest voting bloc of registered voters who do not vote. If you don't do your duty as a citizen, you bear the responsibility for the condition of our nation, our states, and your local government. In a representative republic, the people get the government they ask for. And when they don't represent, they get the government they deserve. I'm Violet Sabo, with points to ponder, words to live by, and ideals which define us.
There is no retreat but in submission and slavery. Our chains are forged. Their clanking may be heard on the plains of Boston. The war is inevitable. And let it come! I repeat it, sir. Let it come! It is in vain, sir, to extenuate the matter. Gentlemen may cry, peace, peace, but there is no peace. The war is actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it that gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God! I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death!
Back with segment two, brought to you by Selkirk Mountain Real Estate, helping God-fearing, liberty-loving patriots get strategically relocated to the heart of the American redoubt. And they especially help folks that are trying to relocate to the northern part of the panhandle of North Idaho. You can check them out at SelkirkMountainRealEstate.com. Don't forget also to check out SocialismToday.info. Lots of information there from the Gem State Patriot senior editor. He keeps adding more information, proving that what we observe and what we already know, it just confirms it. Documentation showing the spread of socialism in the United States. That's at socialismtoday.info. So check that out. Now, before I get to Sam Culper on, I want to share something with you guys. Tuesday night, the elections, there's going to be some coverage, but sometimes it's hard to find out, you know, who's doing a good job of covering it. And very few choices. Fox News is probably going to be the adequate. They'll be adequate. But do you want better than adequate? I got some news here for you. Hold on. Okay. I got a Ameron operator and Radio Free Redoubt listener who contacted me, and he said that he is co-producing a televised live Christian conservative election coverage show called America Stands. This is going to be Tuesday night, beginning at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. And we're going to get the stuff posted there, probably on social media, so you guys will be able to tune in. But he contacted me. He's working directly with Dave Barton from Wall Builders. And they discussed it and extended an invitation to Radio Free Redoubt, giving us permission to carry that coverage. So we will be live streaming that coverage. America Stands. America Stands. I'm going to write that down. This just came in. So it's America Stands. Apparently, Dave Barton is going to be throughout the coverage until the polls are closed or the results are in on the West Coast. They're going to stay. This is going to be a marathon. So anyway, David Barton's directly involved in that. Oh, yes. He says, I know you wanted him to sign your founder's Bible, but couldn't get to the event due to Ameron's activation for the hurricane. I'm going to try and get a founder's Bible for you and get him to sign it. No way. That is, wow, praise God. That is just amazing. If you guys aren't familiar with that, let him know if there's anything I want him to inscribe. Ooh, I'm going to have to think on that. That would be amazing. And I would pass on that blessing of the Founders Bible that I have onto someone else, because it's been such a blessing to me. There's so much of our American Christian heritage woven through, quotes and source documents that are provided in there right alongside of Scripture showing, it's unmistakable, the Christian heritage and the Christian foundations that our nation was founded on. Amazing, just amazing. So thank you for that. That is just outstanding. I'd be happy to carry that coverage. So be checking RadioFreeRedoubt.com for more information about that. Their YouTube channel, live coverage, and a couple of other channels. So we will be airing that on Radio Free Redoubt. Tune in to that, and I'll be doing some live coverage on election night as well from the Spokane Valley. Okay, this next guest, many of you guys know very well, and many of you have worked with him directly or taken one or more of his excellent courses. We're talking about Sam Colper from Forward Observer, and he has worked tirelessly for several years now, building up an intelligence resource and network for patriots, for preppers, so that you can make informed decisions and systematically go through and handle this information as it comes in, turning that into useful and actionable intelligence for you, your family, your communities, or an organization you might be serving. And as recently as the hurricanes, I know AMRON was activated, and so was Forward Observer with their Fox company. And I'll let him talk a little bit about that. Welcome to Radio Free Redoubt, Sam. Good to hear you.
Yeah, hey, John Jacob. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. And I also appreciate your AMRON guys, because when we did spin up our intelligence section to respond to Hurricane Florence, your AMRON guys were pivotal in getting us information from AMRON operators and then also sharing information back. So it was a really good relationship, and I'm glad we had the opportunity to figure out what works and then also figure out what we can for the next event. So yeah, Fox Company is just kind of a natural outgrowth of a couple of things. A, specifically for SHTF events, there really is no better training opportunity than a hurricane or a wildfire or a riot. And so we have volunteers who say, hey, I want to cut my teeth on this intelligence stuff on a real world, real time scenario where we can actually be helpful in need. I heard Fox Company is partnered with Cajun Navy, an organization called the Cajun Navy Relief. And they, you know, they've been responding to flooding here in Texas. I first heard about them several years ago, but they've kind of gotten national prominence after last year's Hurricane Harvey. And so they're sending out these search and rescue boat teams to rescue people off their roofs and in areas that are going to flood. And terrain and weather is part of METTC. And so, you know, one of the things that we did was help them with understanding the local terrain, understanding weather conditions to provide them early warning of. I first heard about Cajun Navy Relief several years ago. You know, the Cajun Navy, they've been all over the news, especially with last year's Hurricane Harvey. And so one thing that we've been able to do for them is to provide them with current ground intelligence and also with early warning. So we can look at what's going on, both in terms of terrain, especially with flooding. You know, they're sending out these search and rescue teams, these boat teams, and they need a staging location. Well, they don't want to stage somewhere that's going to flood. And so something, you know, as simple as pulling up flood maps and saying, hey, which areas of this county are going to be prone to flooding, identifying those and then, you know, what's probably going to be dry or probably going to be safe from flooding, that not only allows them to help kind of prioritize and understand where the rescue needs are going to be, but that also allows them to build kind of, you know, staging areas where their people can stay dry. And then they can also, you know, down the road launch boats from for the search and rescue. So we've been very happy to do that with them. We had great volunteers. We produced a lot of intelligence for them. And we're going to continue to do that in the future. You know, I guess my message is this doesn't stop at hurricanes. You know, we're going to be around during the next big riot. We're going to be, you know, we want to help in all aspects of emergency management and disaster relief, because intelligence is such a critical part of this stuff.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, you know, once they get knee deep into an emergency, they're like, oh, yeah, actually, I do need to know. I do need to have some kind of knowledge management. I do need the ability to collect information from what's going on beyond my line of sight so I can make better decisions. And that's the ultimate value of intelligence.
Yeah. Well, you've done a great job with that. So I salute you. I commend you and all the work that you've done and all of the folks that have volunteered and stepped up and helped with that. I know that the AMRON operators, they'll really appreciate hearing that from you, because they're pulling double duty. They were not only operating radios on the air and handling radio traffic, but they're also handling the intelligence collection and analysis effort and coordinating as liaisons with Fox Company, with your group, you know, through, well, not Forward Observer, but Fox Company under Forward Observer. So, yeah, hats off to them as well. And just everybody who did their part. I know that there were actual rescues that were executed because of that combined effort. So it was very rewarding.
Yeah, it is. It's nice. It's nice when I'm able to see my Fox Company volunteers apply the intelligence stuff that they're learning through our training. And yeah, without a doubt, I mean, they did contribute to getting people rescued in a timely manner. And frankly, these organizations, they're just so overtasked. And that's what we want to do is say, look, we'll help you surf, open source Facebook and Twitter, and we'll help find people who need rescue that you probably would not have seen otherwise.
Yeah.
And so that's really just something really big that we can bring to the table. And I just want to say this one more time, it was immensely beneficial for volunteers to see what the intelligence process looks like, intelligence in action, so that when this happens in their neighborhood, when the lights go off or whatever kind of event might happen in the future, they know exactly what to do. They know what systems and processes to put in place so that they can have timely information coming in so that they can make better decisions about their security.
Yes, absolutely. Well, good job. So that is a good segue into the main topic that we wanted to discuss, intelligence. From an intelligence analyst perspective, put that up against the backdrop of history with current events that we're dealing with. And that is the Civil War II series that I just started going into a couple of weeks ago. So this is really important because what we're seeing is our nation in turmoil, very clearly divided. And now it's becoming a mainstream topic of discussion, even a mainstream news outlets and in circles and around the water cooler at work, people are actually talking seriously. And they're serious when they say it. And that is, do you think there will be a civil war? And it's a pretty frightening prospect that things have deteriorated to the point where people are actually asking a very valid question. Could this mean we are headed toward civil war? So I've been kind of looking at, historically, well, what's going on right now in our country and talking about historically the indicators of internal conflict that could reach that point of internal strife when you cannot resolve, when one or both sides, two sides or more, decide that they're done negotiating. They don't see any other alternative than to, begin carrying out hostile types of actions. So that's where I want to bring you in. What are you seeing as far as, are you hearing the same thing? People saying, well, do you think there'll be a civil war?
Oh, of course. Yeah, actually I have a bunch of alerts set up and that's, that's topic. I wake up every morning, I write my early warning email out to everybody, the intelligence report. And then I jump into what's the latest that's being published in the New York Times or in the Atlantic or at National Review or any of these other like mainstream publications with mainstream pundits talking about this. So yeah, there's, I think at a certain level, whenever the media reports on anything, I'm naturally cautious. Like, why is this narrative being pushed now? But yeah, This is something that has legs.
You and I want to get into something. It's a term that you and I are familiar with. I'm sure some in the audience are, but it's new to them. I want to build up to this, and that is to talk about something called low intensity conflict. It's a cousin to insurgency, or kind of a category of that. So we'll get into that. But I remember a couple of years ago, matter of fact, almost exactly 2 years ago. November 2016, you were begin talking about and tracking some of what you call early warning indicators of not just conflict, but actual organized political violence. So here we are in the last couple of years, especially in the last 6 months since President Trump has gone full on into his second year. Now we're hearing discussions of inciting violence, if you will, from the left, saying, you know, hurt them, you know, remove civility. It's time for us to stop being civil, confront them in their places where they feel like they should be safe, you know, having dinner with their families or at their homes. And these things are actually the people that they're directing that toward actually responding to that. And they're not just getting in yelling matches. They're actually beginning to carry out violence. So this 2 year point later, since you first started talking about that, where do you see us now as actually approaching that organized political violence stage?
Yeah, well, we are definitely getting closer. You know, just thinking back, in 2004, I dropped out of college and enlisted and became an intelligence analyst. And back then, it was kind of fairly inconsequential choice of that MOS. And now we're 2016, 17, 18. And, you know, if you want to call it providence, if you just want to say, hey, I got really lucky and these skills and training just kind of fell in my lap. But I'm very thankful because from all these things that I've learned through training in Iraq and Afghanistan, one of the most beneficial things that's happened to me and one of the most beneficial things that other people can learn is the difference between intuitive thinking and structured analysis. And that's what we try to do at Forward Observer, structured analysis.
Yeah.
One reason why that is so important is because we quantify the risk, or we can quantify the likelihood of something that will happen. And that's something that's, you know, I liken it. This is the long way of answering the question. This is like showing your work on long division. You know, some people will ballpark it or estimate it, and they might be wildly wrong. But if you actually go through and take the time to apply a structured method to answering this long division problem, we can go back and double check our work, or we can find a place and say, oh, well, we messed up here. So now this is going to affect the answer. And what that allows us to do is start to get very specific with our expectations of the future. One of the greatest things about intelligence is that it reduces uncertainty about the future. So with these early warning indicators, I identified 20 things that would happen along with the emergence of organized political violence. And so in 2016, November 2016, there were 6 or 7 that I could definitively say, yes, these are indicators of organized political violence. November 2017, that number grew to 12. So we went from 6 or maybe 7 to 12. And then in April, we went to 13.
Wow.
And so I'm just about to update those again for 2 years on. And so the way indicators work, specifically early warning indicators, is I have a list of these 20 things. These are the things that I expect to happen before an outright domestic conflict or before organized political violence begins to take place. And so if we're saying 5 or 10, okay, well, there's obviously something there. We get to 15, we get to 17. Well, organized political violence is either already happening or it's imminent. And so this is not to say that I'm expecting a 17 or 18 or 20 of these indicators to exist in November 2018. But it does quantify just how far we've come from this kind of emerging resistance movement.
Yeah.
2 years ago to now, it's like, well, yeah, we're actually seeing coordination on many levels. And so, you know, certainly there are some prerequisites there. Whether they develop into organized political violence, I'm not sure. But the trend right now, what's something to definitely keep an eye on?
What is that? You broke up just a little bit right there. You said definitely keep an eye on.
I'm definitely keeping an eye on the trend lines because the trend right now is pointing towards more organization of, you know, towards the end of organized political violence.
What if you're getting ready to release an updated report? How many indicators are you looking at right now?
Well, in April, the last time I went through and really scrubbed through all the data and updated it, we were up to 13. I would not be surprised if we're up to 15 or 16 by now. it's a lot of work, and so it's not something that I really do week to week. But by the end of this, by Thanksgiving, because that's when I launched it 2 years ago. But yeah, by Thanksgiving, we will definitely have an updated list. I wouldn't be surprised if we're 15 or 16 by now, and out of 20.
And I think it would be fair. Well, let me know if you agree. Each of these indicators magnifies the probability of this these things happening as well. It's like an exponential probability graph. Is that kind of what you're seeing or what you expect? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, an indicator is an observable or potentially observable clue. And so, yes, we do have this compounding effect. It's like, well, if we were at 6 out of 20 and then we're at 13 out of 20, now we're at 15 out of 20. Now, that's not to say that by this time next year in 6 months we'll be at 20 out of 20.
Right.
But it definitely does quantify the risk going forward that says, hey, based on these indicators, there's a heightened likelihood that this is going to happen in the future. The other thing that allows us to do is look at potential future events and say, if these events were to occur, would they trip these other indicators? And so now we can start to piece a timeline to how do we close the gap between 15 and 20 or between 13 and 20?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, so this is what this organized political violence that you're talking about is something. If I'm sure you've read, you know, the Higgins report, the POTUS and political warfare, really explaining what's happening. It essentially appears to be almost like a coup or an insurgency. The early, not latent any longer, the early stages of an insurgency, which is starting to fall into that low intensity conflict, minus the violence. I mean, almost we're still dealing with like street level thug type of violence, with Antifa or, occasional executing of a police officer sitting in their car, eating lunch. But now we're almost starting to see these two combined in any type of resistance or revolution. We've seen the political arm, and there is a political arm and there is a military arm. Political arm usually openly disavows the military arm, but they seem to be working, in concert. So all of that combines to that term low intensity conflict. So, and you've been using that term as well. I have in conversations and discussions that I've had with others, but for the Radio Free Readout listeners, what is low intensity conflict?
Sure. Well, I use low intensity conflict because I don't like the term. I actually dislike the term civil war.
Yeah.
Because what's happening right now, we're not yet to a civil war. You might call it a cold war, but low intensity conflict is warfare beneath conventional war, or it's activities beneath the threshold of conventional war. So there are no tanks and troops fighting in the streets. That would be a conventional level.
Right.
We're underneath there, but we're above routine peaceful competition. You know, politics has always been dirty. Politics has always been a very, very dirty sport. It's not always been a conflict sport. And, we're certainly progressing towards that. Not only that, but understanding conflict at all levels, conflict is not just kinetic. It's not just political violence. There's diplomatic warfare, information warfare, political warfare, economic warfare. And that's one thing that I really think is boosting us right now up to the level of low intensity conflict, which is, let's look at the left. Many of them are not just satisfied with beating their opponents politically.
Right.
They want to economically dislocate their opponents. That means getting them fired from their jobs, getting them kicked off of Twitter or Facebook, decreasing their economic opportunities or their economic avenues, getting them kicked off of crowdfunding and off of PayPal and off of, look at what they're trying to do to these arms manufacturers, right? Their banks are saying, oh, sorry, you make guns. We can't be your bankers anymore.
Yes.
And so it's this dislocation that's actually quite concerning, because that's not peaceful routine competition. That's going beyond that.
Right.
And so that's why I say that we're in a low intensity conflict right now. I think our domestic conflict has already started. And if we use the Army's doctrine and understanding of low-intensity conflict, and we look at examples of Iraq or Afghanistan, the sectarian violence, you know, and the political or ideological violence, there's actually a lot of similarities there. So it's for those reasons and a great many others that I say our domestic conflict has already started. We're probably in a very early phase of it, just to be honest.
Yeah, I agree. That's how it appears to me. I started going back through some of my reference books, manuals, and other stuff that, you know, retired military officers have written on low intensity conflict and insurgency, and of course communist guerrilla warfare. Even some of the stuff that that identifies the actions of especially communist revolutionary type of warfare tactics, even Mao insurgency models, is, you know, three, four, 5 decades old stuff. It's timeless. We're actually seeing a lot of these things being played out at the political level all the way down to the street level. And I know that, you know, one of the indicators and several pundits have recently written on this, and that is one of the Civil War indicators is when one side does not accept the legitimacy of the sitting government. And that seems to be what they've been building up. I suppose, you know, the leftists, those that basically have declared their open opposition and to undermine and even subvert the executive branch of our government right now, they're building up the narrative stating that, you know, his presidency is not legitimate because of, you know, corruption, because or just because of the things that he says. He shouldn't be president. So and then, you know, the innuendos or accusations of, you know, Russian collusion and basically the presidency or the elections were basically just a fraud. Whether it's civil war or low intensity conflict, and you're right, civil war, you have military action, conventional level military action taking place between two sides. I don't see that for the foreseeable future. With these, what's going on today in our culture? What do you think contributes to the likelihood of a domestic conflict in America today?
Well, you know, I try very hard not to be myopic in my approach. And so really an understanding of history, really of context, an understanding of appropriate context is so important to analyzing the situation. And one thing that we see in other cultures and one thing we've seen throughout American history is that tectonic shifts in culture typically lead to unrest and violence. We can look at the relationship of those who supported tyranny and those who supported liberty that led up to the American Revolution, the concept of states' rights and tariffs and slavery. These were cultural battles being fought that eventually led to what most people call the Civil War. We look at the Civil Rights Movement and the Cultural Revolution of the 60s and 70s. And, you know, that 1968 was one of the most violent for a quote-unquote peacetime period. 1968 was one of the most violent years in all of American history during a peacetime.
Yeah.
And so now we look at economic disruption, how technology is beginning to place jobs. We see this massive cultural war that includes religion, attacks on religion. We have, you know, we have demographic shifts. Social media. Social media is actually contributing to a lot of this stuff because it allows more extreme rhetoric to be elevated.
Yes.
And by extremist rhetoric, I'm not just talking about pro-Second Amendment or supporting the Constitution, but violent rhetoric. I mean, I'll tell you, a couple months ago, I had to get off Twitter. I got off Twitter for like 3 or 4 weeks because I'd read the stuff that people were saying, and it made me so angry.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you want to talk about how people get radicalized. You know, it's a leftist talking point that many on the right are being radicalized online. You know, and maybe Yes. Some people roll their eyes, but I'll tell you, I certainly understand what's happening to young men when they see people online saying, oh, you know, we're going to take America over. And, you know, I don't want to really get into a lot of this stuff, but I see a lot of like anti-white rhetoric. And then the people on the left go, oh, why are young white men being radicalized? Well, it's because there is no filter, especially on social media. You know, you can get on CNN as well. And, you know, all white men are terrorists. You know, it was white men who rushed to the scene of the Tree of Life synagogue to rescue those people and to provide aid and to stop the shooter. Those were white men. Look at the pictures. Primarily white men running to the sound of gunfire. But white men are terrorists. And so I think, you know, a lot of this stuff is becoming mainstream, and it's just serving to further radicalize us. When we see tectonic shifts in culture, that's when we have earthquakes. And that's really what's beginning to happen now, is that these tectonic shifts are riling people up. And that's what's pushing us into domestic conflict.
One of the things that I've seen from the – you mentioned the 60s and 70s, and that was very much a tectonic shift in our culture and the violence. And we saw, you know, the domestic terrorist organizations, leftists, and the Weather Underground and Symbionese Liberation Army, and these that were actually carrying out bank robberies and assassinations and kidnappings and bombs and things like this. But I hear a lot from the baby boomers, especially – who were, you know, young 20s, older teens in that time, saying, oh, I've seen this before, it'll blow over. So do you think that's kind of a dangerous stance to take on this, to not really, I guess, to play it down or not take it seriously?
You know, when you're thinking intuitively, you have a lot of biases. And, you know, maybe part of that's normalcy bias. Like, hey, America's had this points before that, you know, the 1960s didn't erupt. You know, actually, you read that book by Brian Burroughs, Days of Rage. It's a fascinating book. They go into, you know, SDS and Weather Underground and all these other people, right? And these people really thought that they were starting a revolution.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, yeah, I can understand why people look at that and say, oh, or, you know, oh, the early 1900s, that was a very violent, tumultuous time for America, or the early 1800s, or the 1960s. The problem is that was a completely different, I mean, for all intents and purposes, that was a different country. Today we have different social dynamics. We have different psychological dynamics. We have much different demographics. We have different politics. The Overton window has shifted from the 1960s and 70s. I mean, that's a large reason why the Overton window started to shift to the left, is because of the extremism of the 1960s and 70s. And then we also don't have, you know, back then, yeah, there were some financial instability, you know, throughout several parts of that period, but nowhere close to the instability that we're going to have. Right. And so I look at this and I say, yeah, actually this time it is different. I think it is.
Good. Well, we're going to talk about that when we come back from the break. How might that be different? And I want to get your take on some of the potential outcomes or reactions, I should say, this coming week as we have midterm elections. Extremely volatile situation from my vantage point. And the rhetoric is increasing, and we want to take a look at that from an intelligence standpoint, what we might be able to expect from that. We're with Sam Culper from Forward Observer, and we'll be back in a moment. This is Radio Free Redoubt.
In addition to voting in all elections, become active in government. Run for local, state, and national office, or help select capable people of the highest integrity to serve. Be constantly vocal on all local and national political issues. Tell your representatives in Congress, or even the President himself, What do you think is the best course on issues that come before the public? Number 7. Strive constantly for spiritual growth. We, as individuals, can push the world along toward mankind's highest destiny if each of us will make the welfare of his fellow man his first concern, and if each of us will apply the principles of God's truth to our political and economic affairs.
Are you prepared for an economic, socio-political collapse in America? Do you wonder how something like that could be possible? What would that even look like? I recommend Glenn Tate's 10-book series titled 299 Days. From a lawyer and government insider's perspective, he lays out a plausible scenario that could very well come about if we continue on the path we're on as a country. Through his fictional character, he lays out his own real-life journey to prepare himself and his family for the possibility of a future full of difficult challenges and what seem like impossible choices. 299 Days is a high-action dystopian novel written from the perspective of the average Joe American and outlines realistic plans and action steps that you could implement to prepare yourself and those around you for the difficult possibilities ahead. Go to 299days.com to learn more. This is segment 3. Segment 3 brought to you by Strategic Landscape Design. Designs to help keep you safe and to help you thrive on your property, getting the most out of it for sustainability, for water access, gaining your water rights, whether it's food supply, energy production, or built-in security features into the property that you own, or if you need some expert advice, another service that they offer, they'll help look over the lands that you are considering purchasing to help you make the right decision. So check them out at strategiclandscapedesign.com. Okay, if you are just now joining us, we are with Sam Culper from Forward Observer, and we're talking about Civil War II. Well, the series Civil War II, but probably more realistically, low-intensity conflict for right now. Looking at the insurgency, looking at the what could be an insurgency or possibly a coup, but definitely turmoil in our country as we become increasingly more polarized. So, Sam, thanks for sticking with us here at Radio Free Redoubt.
Absolutely, John Jacob. I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Now, this coming week, we've got some elections. We have some folks that are basically saying we're going to take this on the left. You have the left versus right going on right now. And the left is saying we're going to take these seats. We're going to take back power. What if they don't regain the power that they're counting on? What do you think the reaction is going to be from those on the left?
Well, you know, the left is, the way I see it, the left is not really a monolithic structure. You know, just like in the, there are different flavors of Republicans and there's different flavors of Democrats.
Right.
So really, you know, it kind of depends, well, which Democrats or which left are we talking about? You know, one thing that I've been fascinated is with following, I call them alt-left. So, you know, radical anarchist groups and communists and, you know, especially the revolutionary groups, they actually dislike the Democrat Party. I mean, they routinely routinely go after Democrats, you know, and they almost have this like liberals are next kind of attitude, like after the fascists and Nazis.
Right.
So, you know, so for them, you know, it's difficult. It's really difficult to say. Because you have to take some of these groups, they're so autonomous and there is no command and control function. So, you can't just say, oh, well, this leader says this, so this is what everyone is going to do. But, yeah, I think we could see a lot of the same things that we've already seen. Political violence, certainly. Mm-hmm. Sporadic could be more than sporadic.
I think what concerns me is now we are seeing people in Congress, or Hillary Clinton,
Maxine Waters, Eric Holder, people like this that are saying we need to take it to them, and people are responding to that. I think that's what's different about this. I think that it's almost like there is an official disconnect, but unofficially, you've got the political arm doing what political arm does, and you got the militant arm or the street level, what I compare to the brown shirts, really, that we saw in the rise of Nazi Germany. Is that something that you're observing, and do you think this is going to play a part into this, especially in light of the potential outcome for the elections?
Yeah, I wrote an article about that a couple of weeks ago about how one potential way forward, and then I was listening to last week's show, and it's kind of touched on as well. There is a kind of loose relationship, or I wouldn't necessarily call it a symbiotic relationship in every case, but in general, I think that's a decent rule of thumb that, yeah, militant wings and political wings who are ostensibly nonviolent, or at least promote nonviolence, work together. I mean, we saw that. We saw that with the rise of anti-fascism in 2016. And I really use that term very loosely, where Democrats said, oh yeah, violence is bad, but you know what? Those Antifa guys, they're not so bad. Like, they mean well.
Yeah. You can understand why
we'll give
why
these people
frustrated.
The benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you either shun political violence or you don't. Like, you can't say, well, in some cases, political violence is acceptable, because what you're saying is that eventually, in every instance, political violence will be acceptable. And so, yeah, there definitely is a slippery slope there. As far as whether or not the Democrats are able to take back the House, one thing that I think, let's look at what the right was doing during Obama, right? Because we had some of the same talk, the 3% movement, and kind of the return of the 90s militias and so forth. But one thing that I think keeps people from engaging in violence is their personal lives, but also B, it's like every 2 years we have an election. Every 2 years there's another opportunity to flip the tables. And so I actually think that that's been of some benefit to our social condition, especially on the bubble, right? Because basically what we're talking about is if you're on the 10,000 people of either side, on the far right or the far left, who are trying to foment discord and use divide and conquer and trying to radicalize people, really what we're talking about is people kind of in the middle, the people on the bubble. You're always going to have your coexist people, right? Your boomer conservatives and then your kind of mainstream Democrats that say, oh, hey, everything's great. We just have to try to get along. And so really there's like 25% on either edge, on the left and the right. And once those people become radicalized, that's really what's going to tip the scales. The question is, I don't think it's so much a question of what happens in the election. I think it's what happens as a result of the election. We look at Iraq and Afghanistan. Let's take Iraq especially, right? How do you – and what the Islamic State and these other people have done. How do you radicalize people? You say, oh, the government is oppressing you, and you look for every instance of potential government oppression, whether it's real or perceived, and you exploit that. And so if the Republicans – do somehow keep the House, they certainly could. I don't know. But if they do, then I would look at rhetoric. I mean, I would look at flat out information operations where Democrats say, we tried to beat back the Nazis, that we have a fascist government and, we need to politically resist. I don't think that Democrats are necessarily going to just stand up and support violence. Certainly there will be some, but I think by and large, most Democrats won't. I think most Democrats will just continue to say, hey, look, these people are oppressive. They're, like Joe Biden said a couple of years ago, they're going to put you back in chains. And so I think they're just going to use that rhetoric to try to continue to build political power. I mean, that's the fundamental strength of the American system, is that the next election is 2 years away. You can rebuild political power, whether the Democrats have a winning message or not. Well, that's kind of up to them. But if the Democrats don't win, I think you're going to see a huge shift back towards left-wing populism, because that's what's going to sell. That's what's going to sell to the blue collar and a lot of middle class people.
Yeah. It's interesting to see such a rise in this last this most recent election cycle of viable candidates who are openly declaring themselves to be socialist Democrats, supported by folks that are waving, you know, communist flags and so on. And that's very interesting to see that that type of just overt, I would call that the left, extreme left, where that's being openly accepted, you know, in among several of these candidates. So it doesn't look like anything I've ever seen or read about. Let me rephrase that. What I'm seeing here doesn't appear to be a temporary trend. The buildup toward conflict and division within our country doesn't seem like something that's going to be just blow over. It seems to just keep building and building. So do you see this just fizzling out in the next couple of years, and then we just kind of go back to situation normal and everything's fine? We just have differing opinions, but it's live and let live?
Well, nothing's going to fizzle out until social, cultural, and economic disruptors fizzle out as well. I think there's a long – go ahead.
I was going to say, what is that? Can you explain that?
Well, you know, demographic shifts. You know, I mean, the 1965 Immigration Act gave us the kind of the mass immigration that we have today. And, you know, we look at – I just finished this really great book. It's called The Populist Explosion, all about why populism has come roaring back to the United States and Europe. And one reason is because it's backlash against globalization. We look at – American jobs. And actually, you know who has a really good talk about this is Seth Godin. You know, Seth Godin said, look, you go back to 1600, what was the unemployment rate? Zero. Because the concept of jobs and employment had not yet been created. And he said, that's the era that we are going back to. It's not enough that American jobs have been outsourced because someone in Singapore or Vietnam or China or India will do it for cheaper than you can. It's that those jobs will be permanently going away due to robotics and machine learning and automation and artificial intelligence.
Right.
And so that's something that's fundamentally disruptive to the economy. As long as our economy is being disrupted by technological advances, we are going to see the symptoms. And the symptoms is political unrest, social unrest, along with the culture war that we're seeing today. Fundamentally, the culture war is about – what does it actually mean to be an American? Which America is going to exist in another 10 or 20 years?
Right, right. That's the question we're all asking.
Sure. Yeah. Can you give me
the name of that book again? Populism.
Yeah, it's called The Populist Explosion.
Oh, The Populist Explosion. Okay.
Yeah, Populist Explosion. It's by John Judis, J-U-D-I-S.
Okay.
Who is, I believe, a Democrat. But it's a great book. It's a great book. And so this backlash against globalism, it's not ending. You know, Steve Bannon said the other day, I mean, say what you want about Steve Bannon, he's a political and social cultural commentator. And so I typically read what he has to say because he's one of the ringleaders of the populist explosion in the United States. And so he says, look, we're in the first inning of the national populist rise. And it's, you know, he's started a political action committee here in the United States. He started a political movement called The Movement in Europe. And so right after the midterms, he'll be going back to Europe to try to flip the European Parliament elections in May to put some national populists in there. And so, you know, if that is the case, this is another tectonic shift. If more Americans, if Donald Trump's just the start of this more nationalist populist movement, then yeah, we're going to continue to see the culture war spill into political violence. The other thing I want to say is we look at youth unemployment, and whether we're talking about the Arab Spring or in Africa or in lots of other places where youth unemployment is high, that's almost always an indicator of civil unrest. And so we look at this next recession in 2020. I think it's probably going to happen in 2020. Lots of people are saying that. You know, one great thing with these early warning reports that I write every morning is I'm looking through all the latest economic data of the day, the latest manufacturing and jobs reports and inventory and all these other things. But looking at this, the consensus seems to be – I'm not an economist, but the consensus of economists and analysts say, yeah, it could very well happen in 2020. Some people say it's 100% in 2019. Well, even if it's 2021, we're going to have a high rate of youth unemployment, right? Because who loses their jobs? Right. It's always retail, service industry. Typically young people bear the brunt of that.
Right.
And so we have high youth unemployment. We have a toxic political environment. And then we have – there is no promise that these people affected by the recession will have jobs to go back to because of the continued advancement 5-10 years from now, the continued advancement of artificial intelligence, which is just going to radically change our economy. And what are these people going to do?
Right. A lot of change is coming. Oh my goodness. It's complex. It's so far wide reaching. It's not just about, I want women to have abortion and you don't, so I'm going to come over and burn your house down. The social implications are so wide, and it's reaching into our institutions as well. So, very interesting stuff. Well, we're going to take another break and we're going to come back. Before we take a break, though, can you give the folks out there what they need to know about how to get your daily intelligence reports, the early warning?
Yeah, our website's at forwardobserver.com. And I don't know if we're going to have the chance to talk about it, but what I want to do for listeners is I'm going to write an email series, like 4 or 5 emails, talking about area studies. And maybe we'll get to that. But I want to make sure everyone understands why an area study is useful, what goes into an area study. So I'm just going to write out a course for everybody. No sales, no nothing like that. I just want to make sure everyone has that information. But if you want to go to forwardobserver.com/JJS, as in John Jacob Schmidt, then you can sign up for that. And it's not a spam thing, I promise. I'm going to write articles, and I've wanted to write this for a long time, and now it's like, well, I have plenty of motivation to do it now.
Good.
Or I guess accountability to do it now. So, and then if you're there at Ford Observer and you like what we say, we do employ several analysts, intelligence analysts. Many of us are veterans, and we publish intelligence reports. And one of the things that we do is publish early warning. It typically gets emailed out around 8:30 a.m. Central Time. And it's all the day's threat intelligence in one package. So we look at what government's doing. We look at what's happening around the world. We look at the latest economic news and information. And I'll tell you, let me just say one thing. And I'm not – do I have time? Can I do this real quick?
Yeah. And we'll take a break. Okay. So you get that out. You bet.
The other day, one of the major SHTF survival prepper websites ran an article. November 1st, 70% market crash, right? Oh, this guy, he's called every market crash and recession and financial crisis since 1827. And he's the guy, and now he's saying November 1st, right? Come buy this. You have to buy his report or go. And what we do is nothing like that.
Right.
We're very methodical. We're very structured. It's evidence-based reasoning. We source as much stuff as we can. So if you're not sure, go back and read the actual source and see what they say.
Yeah.
And so we're just trying to apply some sanity to a problem that everybody has, which is how do you improve your information literacy? So that's what we try to do.
I would say
that's one of the main benefits is timely intelligence that you can trust. I stake my name and my company's reputation on that, and that is what we do.
I agree. I can attest to that because I do get your early warning intelligence brief every morning. I have, I think, from its inception, from when you first started it. And it's very well done, very professional, and I appreciate it, everything that you do and everything that goes into that. So thank you. Keep up the good work. So forwardobserver.com, and then click the subscribe to the early warning daily intelligence report. And would you say add JJS in there?
Yeah, JJS. Yeah, they can sign up. I'll send them a bunch of stuff for how to build an area study.
Perfect. Okay, that'll be super helpful. All right, we're with Sam Culper. We'll be back right after this.
Have you all noticed the endless stream of problems we've had to deal with from the West Side's politics? While we are all very much aware of those endless problems and corruption, let me invite you to become solution-minded instead. We already have 16 of the 20 counties on board at the grassroots level. Liberty State is the solution and has an average of 74% support across Eastern Washington. We will be entering stage 2 of our plan in January 2019, and we are also 95% finished with our Liberty State Constitution that we will be submitting to our county volunteers to vote on in early 2019. Is the West Side obliterating all our United Eastern Washington votes on every issue? Yes. So it's a good thing we have the solution that will eliminate the few West Side counties' ability to override our vote with the creation of Liberty State. Is the West Side running roughshod over our Second Amendment? Yes. So it's a good thing we have the solution in Liberty State that adheres to the Constitution and strengthens our constitutional rights. Is the West Side regulating our farms and businesses into inoperability? Yes. So it's a good thing we have the solution in Liberty State, which would eliminate all those excessive regulations. I ask you to please grab on to the life raft that is Liberty State, which is passing you right now. It is the solution to these problems and more. It is easier to divide the state than to fix it, especially since fixing it at this point would be virtually impossible. We must stop focusing our precious time and energy on the problems being sent our way, which have no end in sight. It's time we all become solution-minded instead and focus on our effort to divide the state and restore the power of our United Eastern Washington vote. Join the solution today. Decide to volunteer or donate to the Liberty State effort and make a difference that counts. The sooner we all focus on this solution, the sooner we will be able to get it accomplished. I'm Lady Liberty, and this is a public service announcement on behalf of Liberty State. Visit us at libertystate.org today.
And the fourth and final segment here at Radio Free Redoubt, winding down episode 1839, is brought to you by Works Holsters. That's W-E-R-K-Z, Works LLC. For your custom holster needs, custom holsters and mag pouches. And they also carry the Liberty State seal or the Liberty State flag holster. You can have that added as well. And they donate part of the proceeds to libertystate.org to help support that effort. So go to works.com for more. Okay, once again, we are with Sam Colper from Forward Observer, and we're talking about Civil War II / low intensity conflict, kind of where we are and where we're headed, and trying to make sense of everything as our culture is increasingly divided, even talks of hostility, and the open question now, the mainstream question now that's being asked so often is, do you think we're headed toward a civil war? Well, it seems like we're on that trajectory, however you want to define, you know, a civil war or low intensity conflict. It still is two sides that essentially it deteriorates into conflict because one or both sides decide that everything else has failed and they're basically left with no choice but to actually, you know, start carrying out hostilities toward one or the other. So as we look at this and look at history and seeing where we are, I want to ask you, Sam, what historical conflict do you see playing itself out? What could we look at and say, this is what you saw in this conflict back here is what you can expect to see in the United States?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, the United States is kind of the exception to history. And I think our conflict is probably also going to be the exception to history. It's tough to say. I will say this, in terms of fascism or Nazism, I don't see Trump as a fascist. I don't see there may be things that he says that I think, wow, I would not have said that, or I wish he didn't say that. But I don't, I really don't, because look at the people he surrounds himself with. Yeah, they're right-wing people, but they're not fascists.
Right.
And I actually don't think we'll see fascism under this Republican president. My concern is that we do have a recession in 2020 or 2021, and it's so bad, and the Democrats adopt kind of this left-wing populist message that says, oh, we're in late-stage capitalism. What did you think was going to happen? It's the Republicans who promote capitalism, this vulture capitalism that exploits the worker. And yeah, we do. In a future election, we do have a huge wave of social Democrat, or what do they call themselves? Democratic socialists.
Yes.
Who come into power. And that, you know, that's kind of my worst case, but most realistic scenario going forward, just to be frank.
Right. Well, it's really interesting to watch the elections that just took place in Brazil this last week. You know, it's like Trump 2.0. He's going to, and of course, those on the political left side of the spectrum are just in freak out mode, because he's going to lower taxes. He wants to, because of crime, he wants to make it easier for people to be able to arm themselves, to defend themselves. And what are you seeing as far as talk, or I don't know, how close are you following that? Are you seeing some real parallels between the socio-political climate there and what we have here?
Yeah, well, one of the things you have in Brazil, we actually wrote about this last year in our strategic intelligence summary. One of the things you have happening in Brazil is actually a resurgence of the Christian right, and lots of corruption. And, you know, Bolsonaro was just kind of the right guy at the right time, who had this populist message. By the way, over the summer, this guy named, I think it's Alejandro Duque, I forget his first name, but it's Duque. He was a right-wing populist elected in Colombia. And we see all these right-wing populist, you know, nationalist populist movements getting their leaders elected in Europe. And I do see kind of this pendulum swinging back. You know, when all these neoliberals and leftists complain about the decline of the international order, all they're complaining about is their left-wing power being uprooted by right-wing populists.
Right.
And so, I mean, that I do think this Bolsonaro thing is just part of a broader trend. We'll probably continue to see that. I don't follow it that closely, but I can confirm there absolutely is a global trend right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to clarify that, this seems to be a populist nationalistic wave that's taking the globe. That's what you mean when you say this is going global. But it is it's the antithesis to globalism. So you have this, you know, we're all global citizens. We need to get rid of borders versus this strong uprising in populist nationalism. And that's what they're really taking President Trump to task for. But we're seeing it. He's not the only one who's speaking the language that their constituents want to hear. We are seeing it in Europe. We are seeing it in South America. So very, very interesting. I was going to ask you, you say, you know, looking at prior conflicts in the past, you know, we have Bosnia, you have South Sudan, you've got Ireland and the IRA, you've got, all the way back to the Bolshevik Revolution, and so many of these conflicts in the last, let's say, 120 years. Is there any one of those that you could say that right there is what you could expect to see in America, or any of those stand out?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I didn't answer your question last time. Well, you know, I think Yugoslavia might be a decent case, because that was a breakup among ethnic and kind of also religious lines with the Serbs and the Bosnians, the Croats. I mean, basically you have competing nations within a country. And actually, I just wrote about this in the National Intelligence Bulletin we published on Friday.
Oh.
Is that America is not really a nation anymore. It's a country of competing nations. And you ask, well, what is a nation? Well, a nation is an extension of your tribe. A nation shares a common language, a common ancestry or heritage, a common culture. And we can't say that about America anymore. We're not a melting pot. We're like a fruit salad.
Right, yes,
you know, we're not all American. We stress our identity. And, you know, in conflicts, especially in in violent conflicts, you don't negotiate your identity. And so if your identity first, if you're a white nationalist, say, well, I'm white primarily, or I'm a European American, or you're black or Hispanic, and you say, well, I'm black or brown, you know, that's my identity. And America is a, you know, tertiary identity. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, of course, because you belong to a completely different nation than your neighbor who is a different skin color or different political or a different economic class, and who represents his or her own nation. And so that's, you know, when Angela Merkel and David Cameron and all these other politicians in Europe say multiculturalism has failed, well, we're just seeing the logical conclusions of multiculturalism in the United States, and it also fails. And that's, I think, why another reason why we're heading to the point that we are. And so I would say Yugoslavia. You know, I've got like 10 or 15 books that I've acquired on the Spanish Civil War and also on the breakup of Yugoslavia. I haven't read them yet, and I wish I knew a lot more about Yugoslavia. But what I know, it seems to me that that would probably be the conflict that will most resemble our own. But again, I want to stress, America is an exceptional country.
Right.
And so I think our conflict will kind of, you know, it might resemble other conflicts, but it's going to be uniquely ours.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's a really good observation. And it's also very interesting, the term, you know, to identify United States right now as really a country of competing nations, because so many analysts over the last two or three decades have looked at the United States and seen the not to have multiculturalism, you know, it's not a failure because you have somebody that's not your skin color living in your country. It's the forced multiculturalism for the sake of multiculturalism. You lose that homogenesis, you know, which you know you see today in Poland, in the Czech Republic, and Hungary, where they're striving to protect that, to say this is who we are as a people, and this is why we don't want to take this, you know, this Muslim invasion from Africa, because we want to preserve that. So Europe is really admonishing those countries for not participating in the very forced acceptance of multiculturalism that has caused and led to the failure that the rest of Europe has identified as a failure, multiculturalism, for the sake of having multiculturalism. Is that
Jacob, if I could just virtue signal for a moment, because I don't want the SPLC to come out and say, oh, Sam Culper's promoting white nationalism.
Thank you for doing that, because I know where you're coming from, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. You know, right, we have essentially a monoculture.
Right.
Right. And that is from day zero of basic training, you are kind of indoctrinated into this monoculture. And in 2006, I was nearly killed right next to a black guy, and he was my brother. And we had a Muslim in our unit. And those guys, that wasn't a black guy or Muslim guy. You know, those were my brothers in my army unit.
Yep.
And so, you know, and if America was like that, that would be great. If everyone said, hey, I'm American first, and that's the bonds that bring us all together with what we think politically, that would be fantastic. Unfortunately, human nature doesn't allow that to happen. And human nature can be suppressed to a degree, right? Because I can be aware of my nature, right? I mean, when we're toddlers, 2 or 3 years old, we steal stuff. we're little thieves.
Right.
And your parents come in and say, no, you can't steal stuff. You have to share. You have to let him take his turn. Okay, well, you know, that can happen in America with regard to race or whatever. The problem is that with identity politics, it's been exploited to such a degree that it's a generation in a making. It's a generation in the making, at least.
Yeah.
And it's, if we ever turn the corner, it's going to be at least another generation. Fortunately, I think we're probably going to fight a war before we figure that out, before we figure out how to turn back on identity politics based on race or based on you know, oppression. Oh, I'm oppressed. You know,
to clarify what you were saying, to clarify that, even using the word identity now has become a launch board for leftists, especially to say, oh, these guys are evil. They just use the word identity. But we're talking about the true sense of identifying yourself, how you identify yourself. What is your national identity? What makes you American? Is it just because you've got an imaginary border drawn around you, so now you're American? But we're talking about your identity as American principles, the principles that the founders had envisioned when they formed America. And just what you just said, are you an American or are you black or are you Scottish or are you this or that? Or are you American? The problem that I see is that we have, and it's not even a matter of the color of somebody's skin. It has to do with competing but incompatible ideologies. For example, America's not going to fail because we have some Muslims living in America. But we know historically, once they reach a certain population, they will assert Sharia law. And Sharia law is in direct conflict with the United States Constitution and all the principles that led to the making of the Constitution. So there's conflict there. There's also conflict with Marxism and the United States Constitution. They're incompatible. That you can't just all just get along because, for example, Islam, the tenets of Islam are to dominate, to conquer, and to overthrow and displace anything that's not Sharia law. So that's our future conflict if you know, you allow these trends to continue. It has nothing to do with hating anybody. It's just, do you really want to preserve Americanism and our foundational principles and documents and our laws and our Constitution? Or do you want to have it replaced? Or do you want to just create a conflict where you're going to have to fight to preserve that? Or it won't be preserved without a fight. And that's the part that agitates me, are those who have pushed things to a point where they're forcing us to choose between submitting to something that is completely incompatible with our what makes us American, namely our Constitution. And I mean, I'm thinking of the Constitution when I say that. Or they're forcing us to either submit to a new system or to fight to preserve that which is America and Americanism.
You know, John Jay, can I give a quick example? You and the American, I say readout because I'm from the South, but you and the American readout and us in Texas, or we in Texas, are dealing with the same issue. That's Californication, right? Yeah. I spent a summer in Bozeman, Montana, and we started calling it Bo's Angeles because so many people from Southern California were moving in. And, you know, we have this T-shirt here in Texas that says, "Don't California my Texas."
Right.
And it's kind of the same thing. It's culture. It doesn't matter what color they are. White people are coming into Texas and trying to Californicate it.
Yes.
And it's kind of the same thing with Central America. Like, don't turn America into Central America. I don't want to live in Honduras. There's a reason why you're trying to escape Honduras. So come here and, you know, if you're going to come here, be American and assimilate, not try to seek us back to where you came from.
Right. And
you know, it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah. And don't come here to burn our flags in the street and waving your Honduran flag after you've busted down our border fence and barged your way in and then demand taxpayer, funded social programs. So, yeah, it's a big problem. And this is, you know, we want to seek peace, always want to live in peace. But it irritates me that they're forcing people to have to fight for their existence, you know, for us to exist as Americans, as, you know, our traditional values and ideals, our heritage. So very complicated, no doubt about it. Okay, in this, I would say let's wrap this up and let me ask you this. What is your advice? And this is a great discussion. What is your advice to the patriots out there who see it coming to. Everybody says, do you think there's going to be a civil war? And pretty much the answer, whether it's left or right, is yes, I don't see any way around it. Where does that leave us? What is the person in this listening audience, what do they need to be doing from your perspective?
Well, number one, you have to take all your money and you have to buy food and silver. And if you just buy enough food and silver, you're going to get through this. No, just kidding. Well, obviously, I say intelligence, right? I mean, no amount of beans, bullets, and Band-Aids is going to allow you to collect information from the other side of town.
Right.
No amount of beans, bullets, and Band-Aids is going to reduce uncertainty about the future. No amount of silver bullion and 20 years worth of freeze-dried food is going to allow you to look at your current conditions and say – allow you to understand what's happening now and then by extrapolation form some logical and accurate conclusions about what could happen in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Only intelligence does that. And so really my message is complete an area study. Look, you know, in this email series I'm going to email out, you know, there's six layers of this area study. And I'll share them with you now just briefly. Physical terrain, human terrain, critical infrastructure, politics and governance, economy and finance, and military, law enforcement, and security. And if we understand those six layers, we're going to be in a much better position to anticipate things that are going to happen in the future, whether it's an economic collapse or a financial crisis or a massive cyber attack or whatever event you think could happen in the future. If we can't anticipate local effects, it doesn't matter what caused it. And too many times people are, you know, out there trying to front run the next cyber attack, which is impossible, instead of saying, oh, hey, you know, how many people in my neighborhood are going to need to be fed within the first 12 hours of the grid going down? Or at what point are we going to start seeing mass migration because of lack of water supply or lack of food or X, Y, or Z event that happens in this major city or in this population center?
Right.
So it all comes back to intelligence, local understanding, local conditions, learning how you can be exploited by certain things, and then also understanding local vulnerabilities and local strengths, right? Because we can exploit our own strengths for maximum good, and then we can mitigate the risks posed to us by these vulnerabilities. And if we can identify that first, our chances of survival go way up.
Yeah, absolutely. It's huge. And of course, I push that from a communication standpoint too. You know, if that grid down event takes place, the turmoil, whether things are shut off on purpose or, you know, some event takes our communications down, we have to be able to communicate and coordinate with one another. But when you do communicate, what are you communicating? Intelligence. So those are symbiotic. If you have intelligence and no way to get it from point A to point B, you know, you have a communications gap. If you have a communications infrastructure set up, but you're not able to, you can just talk to each other and share, I guess, the weather and how the kids are doing. But if you don't have an intelligence system process in place, you're not getting the most out of that communications network. The purpose of the communications is to be able to share intelligence. You know, information and intelligence. So they work together. So I appreciate everything that you're doing. You guys have given our communications network purpose, because I know many of the Ameron operators, they've done your area study that you've outlined and made use of that. And in real world emergencies, wildfires and hurricanes, they're actually using the intelligence process that you lay out and turning around and relaying that or, you know, throughout the communications network. So it's a really good relationship. I really appreciate everything that you're doing out there, and just keep up the great work.
Well, John Jacob, thanks so much for the opportunity. And again, if anyone wants this free information, it's just forwardobserver.com/JJS. That'll start going out this week.
Oh, that's where the JJS came in. Okay. forwardobserver.com/JJS.
That's correct.
You got the page set up there for RFR listeners to be able to go and get that information. I had a disconnect, so thank you for explaining that one more time. And are there any parting shots on this topic that you want to leave the listeners with that we haven't touched on?
Well, that's a loaded question, John Jacob.
It is. that was a surprise question.
You know, it's just that intelligence is really most overlooked aspect of survival and preparedness. And if we can't anticipate the future, then we're more likely to be wrecked by it.
Yeah.
And intelligence is the only thing. Having this methodical, systematic forming logical conclusions about what's going to happen in the future, that's what intelligence does. That's what intelligence is for. I have a lot of free you can go to my website and, you know, read about my thoughts and also read about how to do local intelligence, because at the end of the day, I hate using that term. I shouldn't have said that. But when we talk about emergencies, we're going to need to make time sensitive decisions. And the more information you have, the better your decisions are going to be. If you have no information, you're not going to make very good decisions.
Absolutely.
So it really starts with intelligence.
You bet. You bet. Okay. ForwardObserver.com/JJS is where folks need to go. Sam, I want to thank you so much for taking the time. I do look forward to following up with you as these things unfold. I'm very interested in getting your take on this stuff.
Yeah. Have me back anytime. I'd love to share. And thank you so much for the opportunity, John Jacob. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Before I let you go, one other question. You have been just prolific in training and setting up a training schedule where you're traveling and putting on these community intelligence courses. Can you give us some updates on that and what's your schedule looking like? Do you have any of these trainings lined out in the future across the country, in the near future?
I do. You know, I've been so busy that I have stopped doing as many courses. But I did get an email out from someone in Eastern Washington, North Idaho / Eastern Washington about doing a course out there. I was just out there earlier this summer, so I may go back again. I have a class in Knoxville in December. And, I'm so busy, and these classes take 4 or 5 days to put on, including travel time. So, I'm really transitioning a lot of my training online. So last year we launched this thing called the Schoolhouse. So I have the SHTF intelligence course on there. So it's most of the SHTF intelligence course, but kind of in a crash course format, and it's available online.
Perfect. Okay. That's where we can send people to then. All right, that's it. Sam Culper from Forward Observer, thank you so much for being with us. We'll follow up with you.
All right. Thank you, John Jacob. Have a good evening.
You too. Bye now. All right, that's a wrap, folks. Thank you for tuning in. You guys have a blessed week. Don't forget to get out there and vote if you haven't already. More than that, we do our fighting on our knees. We do not war against flesh and blood. We are in a spiritual war and a war for the soul of our nation. So I implore you to do all your fighting on your knees. Take it to him. Pray for our country, for our protection, for his hand of protection over our country, for repentance, so that we turn back to him, so that he can return the many abundant blessings back to this country. And I just thank you guys for being out there. And thank you for your prayers of support. Thank you for the words of encouragement. Thank you for helping to financially support us. We greatly need it. So I can't emphasize that enough, but I've never really been very good at that. So I'll just leave it at that. But we're grateful. If you prayerfully consider that, if Radio Free Redoubt is a blessing to you and you think it's worth supporting, we just definitely appreciate that. All right, guys, have a blessed week. This is John Jacob Schmidt, and you've been listening to Radio Free Redoubt, the voice of the American Redoubt. Good night.